the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. It can be frightening to hear about the spread of the coronavirus. It has killed hundreds in China, infected nearly a dozen in the U.S., with six of those cases here in California. But today, we'll separate fact from fiction and talk about what we know and don't know about the virus. Plus, the novel American Dirt has upset many Latinx writers, why the book and its buzz is pointing a finger at the lack of diversity in the publishing world. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Nice to be back on the microphone today. We missed you all during the impeachment trial, but we have been working away to set up a great show this afternoon. Coming up, mail-in ballots go out today, and one of the more contentious and competitive races to vote on this March will be the race for district attorney. We'll catch you up on the candidates in about 30 minutes. Plus, we'll also talk about Kobe Bryant, the dad, and how, as a father of four daughters, he championed women's sports. We'll hear from a former WNBA player about his impact on the league. But first, concerns about coronavirus are growing in Southern California, with the U.S. government restricting travel from China and the White House calling the virus a national emergency. But how have Chinese-owned businesses in the San Gabriel Valley been affected? Caroline Champlin went to find out.
I first went to Mian, a Sichuan restaurant in San Gabriel, well known for its spicy, numbing noodles. Zan Fen is the owner.
Have you seen less customers in the last couple of weeks?
No.
The same?
Just same.
Just same means the restaurant is packed, with people lining up outside. But Feng points me to another restaurant in the same strip mall. This place is called Tasty Dining. They specialize in food from Wuhan, which also happens to be the epicenter of the coronavirus. I talked to Ming Chun, one of the waiters. Today, it's half empty, which he says is unusual.
Last month, we can do 70 or 80 orders per day, but now just 40 orders.
He says customers are concerned about the outbreak. They wanted to know if the restaurant is safe to go to.
They called you to ask?
Yeah. Do you have any employees from Wuhan now?
He says no, nobody working in the restaurant has been to Wuhan recently, although his boss is there now. He's stranded, so his wife is running the place back here. Chen understands that people living in America are talking with people in China, which can make them very worried.
Are you scared at all?
No.
You're not scared?
I'm not scared, but I'm scared the American. You know, the American have disease now. It's very strong.
He's talking about the flu, which he says is a bigger problem than coronavirus. Last week, he even went to CVS to get a flu shot just in case. Chen says he won't turn anybody away if they're from Wuhan. We're all Wuhanese now, he says, and we need to figure things out together. I'm Caroline Champlin in San Gabriel.
By now, you've no doubt heard a lot about the coronavirus, both fact and fiction. As of Sunday, Chinese health officials confirmed more than 17,000 cases, with some recoveries. 361 people in China have died from the virus. Now, here in the United States, 11 cases have been confirmed, six of them right here in California. But how much do we know about the virus and how much remains unclear? Well, here to walk us through it is Dr. Robert J. Kim Farley, professor of epidemiology at UCLA and former Los Angeles County Department of Public Health official. Doctor, thanks for coming on Take Two.
It's my pleasure.
Sure. All right, let's start with an explanation of the coronavirus, because I think a lot of people hear a lot of different things and they don't know which one to believe. So tell us, what is it and what's new about it?
Yes, basically, it is a new coronavirus. It's occurred starting in Wuhan City. But it's not that we've never seen a coronavirus before. In fact, even the common cold is a form of coronavirus. There have been, however, two serious coronaviruses that have preceded it. One is SARS that you may have remembered back in 2003 that sickened some 8,000 people and killed about 800 worldwide. And there's also been the Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS, which has also had impact in some 2,400 cases and 850 deaths worldwide.
When we say it's new, though, a new coronavirus, what does that mean?
That means it's basically one that we have not seen. It's in the same class of coronaviruses, but due to the genetic mapping, if you will, of this new virus, it was recognized that this is a different fingerprint, a different virus than what has occurred with the others.
And what don't we know about it right now?
So I think that's a good point, because what we are still trying to find out, for example, is is it transmittable before you have the onset of symptoms? It appears that this is, in fact, becoming the case, which makes it a little bit more worrisome, and that people could be actually infecting others before they themselves came down with symptoms of fever and cough. However, typically, if that is the case, it's most likely it's probably not going to be very efficient prior to symptoms because, again, obviously the coughing itself can produce the droplets that are infective in themselves.
That part that we don't know, doctor, when is there a timeline on when we might know if that's the case?
This really is the $64,000 question, and there's been a lot of research done in Germany where there was a person who came to a business meeting that was asymptomatic, not having symptoms, and then actually infected some others. So there's that information, and the Chinese themselves are rapidly and quickly looking into this situation. We have a better feeling for it. I think relatively soon, I think within the next couple of weeks, we'll have a much better understanding of how much transmission can occur prior to symptom onset.
We're talking to Dr. Robert J. Kim Farley, professor of epidemiology at UCLA and former LA County Department of Public Health official. When it comes to it being here in the U.S., what's the likelihood of someone contracting it here in the U.S. and SoCal specifically?
I think that's a very good question to ask, A, because I think it's very important for your listenership to recognize that the risks in the United States are very low. And the reason is because we do have a very robust system of public health at the national, state, and local levels, so that we are now, as you noticed, rescreening passengers coming into the country. If someone had symptoms, they would be put into what we call isolation away from others so that they would not be infecting others. Or if they have had potential for exposure, they'll be given cards to say, look, if you come down with these symptoms, then you would need to be contacting state and local health departments. Most recently, there have been put in now effects the idea that if you came, were a U.S. citizen coming in from an infected area like Wuhan, you actually would be put into quarantine, which means that you would be held for 14 days after your arrival from China to make sure that you yourself did not come down with disease and affect others, which means, again, the risk for others in the United States is extremely low.
And sometimes with this, doctor, and I'm sure you know this, there's the risk of hysteria spreading. I mean, misinformation spreading as well. We just heard a piece from one of our reporters who went to a Chinese restaurant in the San Gabriel Valley, and they were saying how they were getting calls from people wondering if they should go to eat at that restaurant. How valid would those fears be?
Yes, I think really we need to make sure that we're listening to facts and doing deliberate, careful actions and not panic. I really thought that the Director General of the World Health Organization, Director General Tedros, put it very well when he said, we need facts, not fear. We need science, not rumors. We need solidarity, not stigma.
You mentioned SARS earlier. How does it compare to SARS, which broke out back in 2002, as you mentioned?
Yeah, there are some similarities, it appears, that for example, the incubation period, the time from being exposed to time of coming down with death, ranges from about 2 to 14 days, usually around 5 to 7 days, it looks like, is the average. However, it does appear it's not going to be as deadly in the sense that SARS had a 9.5, let's call it 10%, case fatality rate, knows how many people who had disease symptoms came down with it and actually died from it, whereas we're probably talking about maybe 2%, maybe up to 3% case fatality rate here with the new coronavirus.
And is the plain old flu still something we need to be worried about most?
I think you've made an excellent point that really, certainly for us in the United States, where this risk is very low, for us with the new coronavirus, the real message out to your listenership is that flu is the real killer for us in the United States with some 36,000 deaths a year, and that we need to always make sure that we are being vigilant, ensuring that we have our influenza shots, that we are, when coughing and sneezing, coughing into our sleeves, and making sure that we are doing those things like washing hands also that could also ultimately help for coronavirus as well.
Doctor, I mentioned how you used to be an LA County Department of Public Health official. When it comes to these kinds of situations and all the information that is just being tossed around on social media and all over the place, how frustrating is it for the health department at times like this to try and make sure that, as you said, people get the right information at their fingertips?
Yes, as former director of communicable disease control and prevention for the LA County Department of Public Health, I know that my colleagues still there are working very hard, night and day, weekends, be following up on potential travelers and trying to get that message out of calm, not panic, get the facts out, let people know what they can do, like we were just talking about for influenza protections are also helpful for any thing with this novel coronavirus. So I think that they are working very hard and tirelessly to be able to get this message out.
So just the message, be careful and diligent as you always would be with anything else.
Exactly right.
All right, that's Dr. Robert J. Kim Farley, professor in the Epidemiology and Community Health Sciences Department at UCLA and a former Los Angeles County Department of Public Health official. Doctor, thanks a lot.
It's been my pleasure.
All right, moving on. The California State University System's estimates it would cost nearly $4 billion to take care of a building maintenance backlog in the 23-campus system. The money coming along slowly. It'll take years to catch up on all the needed repairs, and that work falls to a handful of maintenance workers. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez followed one of them on his daily rounds.
Cal State Northridge metal worker Christopher Rooney steps out of his work truck.
We're right behind our Oviatt Library, which is our main library.
He's giving me an unofficial campus tour. I'll call it the Things Christopher Rooney Has Fixed in Nearly 30 Years as a Trades Worker tour. He begins with the 1994 Northridge earthquake. He was a student and a metal worker on campus.
The news was saying to stay out of the valley, stay not to travel, and I knew I had to get here.
He found the library's iconic pillars broken.
I saw, you know, 4 foot by 2 foot, 2-inch thick metal plates that hold the main structural I-beams sheared. 2-inch thick bolts that were just stretched like taffy out of the ground. It was crazy.
After the cleanup, he went back to his daily work fixing air conditioning ducts and other metal repairs. That's what he's been doing for nearly three decades, which brings the tour to now and the large maintenance backlog at Cal State Northridge and other Cal State campuses. Northridge estimates it'll cost $77 million in the next 5 years to get to all the deferred maintenance, renewal, and improvement projects, from $5 million to replace heating systems to fixing vertical posts embedded in the sidewalk.
They call them bollards. They just keep cars or vehicles from going in and out of here, and they have these detachable hasps so they can be removed.
Wait a second, this one's missing a lock.
That one's missing a lock. There's I think I have 15 of them around campus that are missing the locks.
He hasn't been able to get around to fixing them because the shop's other metal worker recently retired. Mike Ulan, campus spokesman for Cal State Chancellor Tim White. He says all 23 campuses have a long list of multi-million-dollar projects and smaller fixes. More than half of the academic buildings in the Cal State system are over 40 years old.
At Fullerton, they need to do some elevator work, generator and HVAC in the library. Long Beach needs to do a sewer line replacement. Los Angeles needs to do new elevators in multiple buildings, fire alarm upgrades. It's things like that.
The university system's total budget is over $7.25 billion. But Ulan Kemp says maintenance allocations haven't kept up with rising costs.
Every once in a while, we'll be able to get some funding for specific projects and new creation of new buildings. But the dedicated funding, which is hundreds of millions of dollars because of the size and the scale of the university, hasn't really come in over the past two decades or so.
Most of the state funding increases have gone to pay for more professors and staff who directly teach and serve students. Back at Cal State Northridge, Rooney says his staff does its best to deal with the wear and tear around campus.
A lot of times there'll be what they call trip hazards, cement will move and stuff, or crack on walkways, and we have to constantly fix that. Handrails get broken, we fix those, because you can get hurt. Once metal breaks, it tends to be sharp, and people can get hurt on that.
Rooney hopes that when additional state money comes through for maintenance, some of it will go to increased pay for trades workers like him. He says funding cuts during the recession meant no raises during an eight-year stretch.
We hear the state, allots more money to the CSU budget, but we don't necessarily see it. We have a saying here, I'll believe it when I see it on my check.
Rooney's union is negotiating a contract to that effect. Chancellor spokesman Ulan Kemp says Cal State is committed to keeping good employees.
We like to pride ourselves on having an affordable, high-quality education. Part of that quality comes down to the facilities. It's the staff to be able to maintain those facilities.
Eulenkamp says deterioration in facilities has not gotten to the point that the student experience is affected, but Cal State wants to make the improvements before it gets to that. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman-Lopez.
The new book, American Dirt, is described as a book about the ordeal of a Mexican woman who had to leave behind her life in Mexico and escape to the U.S. as an undocumented immigrant. The author is not Mexican or an immigrant, but this book is being described as one of the great American novels of its time. We'll hear why some think the publishing biz needs to do a little bit better. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. All right, by now you've certainly heard at least a little something about the controversy surrounding the novel American Dirt by Janine Cummins, the book about one Mexican mother's decision to flee to the border with her young son after a drug cartel kills her family was one of the most hotly anticipated titles of 2020. After its release, it even secured a coveted spot in Oprah's book club. But from there, the backlash has been swift. Latinx writers have been brutal with their critiques, saying the book relies on stereotypes and tropes to describe the migrant experience. Then the publisher, Flatiron Books, canceled the author's book tour over security concerns. In response to the controversy, Oprah released this video on Instagram last week.
So when I first started to hear your comments opposing the selection, I was asking the question in earnest, like, what is offensive? I've spent the past few days listening to members of the Latinx community to get a greater understanding of their concerns. And I hear them. I do.
Here to help us understand the debate surrounding the book and the big picture problem it highlights in the publishing industry, we have with us Esmeralda Bermudez. She writes narrative stories about the lives of Latinos for the Los Angeles Times. Esmeralda, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is feminist writer and novelist Roxane Gay. Roxane, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right, Esmeralda, let's start with you. You and your family immigrated to the U.S. from El Salvador in the 80s, and you lost several relatives to the right-wing death squads that were killing and torturing residents. When you started reading American Dirt, what was your hope?
It was very painful, and it was very just infuriating, honestly. You know, we're living at a time right now in this country where Latinos are being gunned down in El Paso simply for being brown, where people who are immigrants or Latinos or brown being run over with cars. They're having acid thrown in their faces. And along comes a book pitched, packaged, and promoted as the great immigrant novel of our times, with the social service spin that it's going to give a face to the faceless brown masses. And instead, we got this book filled with stereotypes, inaccuracies, misrepresentations, all this pandering. Out of all times in America, this is not the time to take the American public on a narco-thriller safari ride of the border for the sake of entertainment, for the sake of profits. And that's exactly what American Dirt is.
And that's what you called it, right? A narco-novela for the LA Times when you wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us the specific issues you can point to that gives the book this narco-novela feel?
First, let me point out, people could read this book 1,000 times and never pick up on the hurt and pain that it's brought to the Latino community. People say, let me judge it for myself. But it's a tricky thing because how can you possibly judge something that you've never lived, you've never experienced? You haven't walked in our shoes. You don't know what it's like to move through society with these labels of you're exotic, you're dangerous, you're not smart, you're small, you're in need of this great white savior. And you see that repeatedly, those themes in this book. I mean, the woman, the Mexican woman, Lydia, and there's this one section that I think will always stay with me where she, quote, like a puppet on a stool, her little boy, like a puppet on a stool to impress American tourists. And they're so shocked that this little boy knows geography and they say, do it again, give the kid some money. Characters from one of the lead characters from Honduras, a woman, is described, introduced as an accident of biology. The most minor animation of this girl's body, danger rattles off of her relentlessly. Just stop and think for a moment what it feels like as a Latina, as a Central American woman. I've lived through these stereotypes, to read them and to have one of the main characters introduced this way. It's painful.
Roxane Gay, when the controversy first erupted, you tweeted about it, hoping for a more substantive discussion about this. And you wrote, quote, "Who gets to write about the lives of people of color and how they are compensated? It's about a publishing industry that hyped a book about the border by a white woman while overlooking books by Latinx writers or underpaying them for their books." Now, Roxane, you've written several books, had them published. Based on your experience as an author, can you give us a little insight into how the publishing process works?
You know, in general, in publishing, you write a book, you sell it to the publisher, and you hope for the best. But every year, there are a few books that are elevated by the publishing industry. They receive significant advances. This one has a rumored 7-figure advance, which means it's anything over $1 million. It has received robust publisher support by way of touring and publicity ads. And of course, it received Oprah's blessing, which is a guarantee for becoming a bestseller. And so with all of these factors, publishing was really saying, this is the book that we're going to elevate. This is the book that is the chosen one. And there was a lot of publicity material that talked about how this book gives a face to a faceless brown mass. But it's only white people that see anyone as faceless or a brown mass. And so really publishing was saying that we have written a book for white people, by white people, and we think this is the one. And now here we are.
But is there any kind of gray area when a publishing company, as you said, decides to elevate a book? Are they saying that this is the way it is? This is the authentic kind of story? Or is it just because this is a book we can sell?
It's both. I do believe that the people behind this book genuinely believe it's real and authentic, but that's because they're all white. Publishing is notoriously white. It's 80% white women. And so when you have those kinds of people working behind the scenes, they don't even know what they don't know.
What is at the root of the criticism? Is it that a white author wrote about the Mexican and migrant experience, or is there more to it?
For me personally, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There have been white writers, journalists, authors who have done incredible work in the community, and it's not about that at all. It's the way it was handled. And I think one important thing I want to say is that this is really not about a book or this writer. It's about an industry that's been called to task in a profound, passionate way about this very real issue of equality. And here's an opportunity for the big five publishers that control nearly 80% of the book market to take the lead, to say yes, 75 to 90% of the book industry workforce is white. Yes, that gives us severe blind spots. Yes, we need vast and sweeping change. Let's work together to do that.
Roxane, back to the system and the way it operates. How, in your opinion, does it support certain writers and maybe make it difficult for others?
Well, the system supports, in general, white writers, and I would say white, heterosexual, able-bodied, middle-class writers, to the detriment of everyone else. And this support manifests in different ways. Not only are these the writers who get the significant advances, they're the ones who get the publisher support to make sure that the book will be a success. Meanwhile, in the case of American Dirt, there are incredible Latinx writers out there who don't get their stories told at all, who are told that there's not enough of an audience, who are told they don't have enough of a platform. Meanwhile, Janine Cummins has, I think, a few thousand Twitter followers. So it's only certain kinds of writers who are expected to have everything in place before their book is elevated. And that's a problem.
We're talking about the book American Dirt with Esmeralda Bermudez. She writes about the lives of Latinos for the LA Times. Also with us is writer and novelist Roxane Gay. Roxane, does it add to the frustration over all this that Flatiron Books and Macmillan, the publisher, decided to retreat from all of this instead of maybe opening it up to conversation about the issue?
Publishing is consolidating its support behind this book because the book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It is going to be a massive success, probably because of the controversy, because now there are a lot of, especially white people, who, as you said earlier, want to give the book a chance and determine for themselves if it's problematic, even though that's not relevant. And so, you know, publishing is going to certainly double down and continue to support this book. And on the one hand, I'm glad that they're not just throwing their author under the bus, because there were a lot of people who went into making this book what it is. And so the responsibility should be spread equally among the publicity team, the editor, and the author.
Now, along the lines of giving the book a chance, I want to bring up something that writer Sandra Cisneros said on Latino USA this week. She's, of course, the author of the coming-of-age story, The House on Mango Street. On the program, Cisneros doubled down on her support of American Dirt, and I'm paraphrasing what she said, but she chooses to keep supporting the book because she believes it'll help reach a different type of audience that wouldn't otherwise read stories about the migrant experience. Manuela, what do you think?
She also said that to those people, Latinos, basically, that believe that this book, that they see something wrong with this book, and that it's not really about the book, that they should stop and analyze what other pain or rage is it that they have. And she suggests that we write poems about it, that we write poetry. I wish it was that easy, Sandra.
I was going to say, you know that a poem is going to make it all better.
So, you know, here's the thing. I don't think it for me as a writer, you know, to be told, hey, you know what, this audience, we're talking about a white audience here, is not going to listen to you because of your name is Esmeralda Bermudez, because they can't pronounce your name, because they're suspicious of your last name, as Sandra said. So you need to hand your story over to another white person, so that then they could be the bridge, because you cannot speak for yourself. They won't believe you. They don't trust you. What is that?
Roxanne, what about you when it comes to what Cisneros said? If the end means that we're having conversations that we wouldn't be having, does it matter how it got there?
Well, I think the question is, at what cost? Is it worth it to Miriam Gorba, who wrote an incredible review of the book and is receiving death threats? Is it worth it to the people who are once again being caricatured and stereotyped? No, I don't think so. But I also believe that bad books should be written. People should be allowed to make mistakes. And so the book was published. Okay, but let's do better next time. And let's make sure that instead of just talking about diversity and inclusion, let's see publishing actually financially support diversity and inclusion by publishing books from all kinds of writers, and not just white writers who want to write about all kinds of writers.
Now, I know we've been talking about publishing, that industry a bit, but boiling it down, some of this comes down to who gets to create content for consumption. And since American Dirt is in the works to be a movie at some point, I wanna wrap up with this. So bear with me on these stats that I'm about to bring up. Now, a report out of USC Annenberg spanning 12 years, looking at the top 100 grossing films each year, found that Latinos had 3% of lead or co-lead roles. Producers, directors, casting executives, 3-4%. 47,000 speaking roles, 4.5% went to Latinos. So both in front and behind the camera, Latinos just were not there. So where are they? They're the ones paying to watch. According to the Motion Picture Association of America, in 2018, Latinos are overrepresented both as theater goers and also home viewers in relation to the population in the U.S. So if Latinos are consuming Latino-free content, Imanaldo, why should content creators care about diversity?
It's unbelievable to me that in some places in the book industry and in even in my own world in journalism, they say, but Latinos don't read enough. They're not reading the newspaper. They're not reading the books. Why do you think we're not wanting to read as much? Because we don't see ourselves in these pages. Why in the world would I read something that's only going to remind me of these stereotypes of being small, brown, uneducated, dangerous?
But how does that explain then how in TV and movies, Latinos don't see themselves on the screen, yet they're paying a lot of money to see not anyone that looks like themselves?
I mean, it's entertainment. Hollywood is Hollywood, and people go to the movies. You know, I There's tremendous buying power in the Latino community. If you go to the grocery store, I mean, you'll find not just like Mexican crema, but you'll find like Salvadoran cream, Guatemalan cream. I mean, that in terms of business and spending dollars, the business world has figured it out. But when it comes to our minds, the production of our stories, no, there the gate is closed.
Roxanne, for you, when it comes to content creators caring about diversity, how do we incentivize them? How do they get to the point where they'll actually care about some of the things that you brought up and not just be concerned with the bottom line?
I have no idea. I truly don't, because we live in a capitalist society. And so we would have to completely reorder society for people to not care about the bottom line. Like, you know, I think a lot of us say yes to things that we wouldn't necessarily say yes to otherwise because we need the money. You know, for example, I have $160,000 in student loans. So, yeah, there are a lot of things I'm going to do that if I didn't have this kind of debt, I wouldn't have to do. So I think really the incentive is, how do we just tell better stories and focus on more than compensation? And that's just having a good sense of morality. And I don't think that Cummins was trying to hurt anyone, but I also think she was trying to serve herself. And you see that in so many different ways. In the author's note, which only exists because she knew there was going to be a problem, she talks about how her husband was an undocumented immigrant, but her husband is Irish. So come on. And so not doing those things would be a good start. It's the lowest possible bar, and people can't seem to clear it.
Roxanne Gay is a feminist writer and novelist. Esmeralda Bermudez writes about Latino issues for the LA Times. My thanks to you both.
Thank you.
All right, as a voter in 2020, you've had a lot to keep track of. Nationally, the Democratic Party getting closer to sorting out which candidate will take on the president in November. Locally, though, a race that may have been overlooked a bit took center stage last week, and things got a bit intense. Coming up, we'll hear how the three candidates for LA County District Attorney stood up to the scrutiny of a live and engaged audience. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots of news to get to all afternoon long here on KPCC. And the host of All Things Considered, Nick Roman, is here to tell us what he's got cooking.
Well, we spent a few minutes this morning with former Vice President Joe Biden talking about the issues that Californians care about, and you will hear that interview. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez will tell us about a warehouse in Orange County that burned overnight. That warehouse held clothing for people who need, you know, nice-looking jackets or dress shirts or blouses for job interviews, mostly homeless people, some women at domestic violence shelters, vets coming out of the service, folks like that. So they're already raising money to rebuild that warehouse. And all of that comes up when All Things Considered arrives at 4 o'clock after Marketplace at 3, in the frame at 3:30, and a note at 5 o'clock. We step aside for NPR's Iowa caucus coverage.
I got 10 seconds to spare, Nick. So what did you think of the Super Bowl yesterday?
I wanted Kansas City to win, and Kansas City won. I really did, yeah. I remembered that, you know, that Hank Stram game all those years
man.
Ago.
You
I love that game.
Showed
too.
Everyone how old you are. That's Nick Roman, ATC. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Amy Martinez. Last week, the three candidates who want to run the largest district attorney's office in the country were all on stage together for the first time this election season. That's incumbent Los Angeles County DA Jackie Lacey and her challengers, former San Francisco DA George Gascon and former public defender Rachel Rossi. The event was co-moderated by KPCC and the Los Angeles Times, and our own Libby Denkman was KPCC's co-host, and she joins us now. Hey, Libby.
Hi, A.
So I understand things got pretty heated during the program, and you had to stop the debate a few times because of protests from some people in the crowd at the Aretani Theater. What did it feel like being in the room?
The emotions were running really high. Some people showed up to protest Lacey and disrupt the event. Some were from Black Lives Matter or other community groups. And there were also family members of people who had been killed or injured by police in the room. You'll be able to hear some booing and chanting in this audio that we're going to play in just a second. I recognize that they were expressing years of pent-up anger about the way Black and brown people are treated by our justice system. I also tried to keep things on track because it was a live broadcast. Podcast, and we were trying to focus on the issues that our audience asked us to address.
All right, so what were some of those issues that you drilled down on?
First, it's important to understand that George Gascon and Rachel Rossi are running as reformers, painting Jackie Lacey as an out-of-step, traditional, law-and-order type DA. And this is happening in the midst of a national push to elect progressive prosecutors across the country. It's happened in San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Houston, and Chicago, and in many smaller cities and counties. For her part, Jackie Lacey is saying, "Hey, I'm a reformer, too." So for us, the challenge was to find the fault lines between their positions.
Okay, so what were those fault lines?
One place the candidates clashed was over the death penalty. Lacey still pursues it in what she says are the most egregious cases, while Gascon and Rossi say they would never ask for capital punishment.
And Gavin Newsom has ordered a moratorium on the death penalty while he's in office, but this is still a big policy debate.
Right. And another huge policy debate is focused on a large problem for the DA to address, the issue of racial disparities in the criminal justice system. People of color get arrested, charged, and locked up at a much higher rate than white people. And Rachel Rossi pointed out 80% of people in LA County jails are Black and brown. She says LA County is overcharging people and the DA must take proactive steps to fix this, like commissioning outside audits. Lacey said she is committed to diverting as many people as possible and that she pioneered the use of mental health diversion to get people treatment instead of jail time. She also pointed out that most of the victims of crime in LA are Black and brown people. At the same time, she said reforms have to be carried out carefully to preserve community safety.
All right, so how did Gascon and Rossi respond to that?
They both said Lacey has stood in the way of change. They pointed out that she has opposed reforms like Proposition 47, which reduced some nonviolent felonies to misdemeanors. George Gascon co-authored Prop 47. He said reform is always going to be uncomfortable for the status quo.
Prop 47 was the beginning of a major process of taking some of the inequities in the system, such as having possession for crack cocaine being a felony, possession of powder cocaine being a wobbler, could be a misdemeanor or a felony, when we know that who was going to jail for those felonies happened to be people of color.
Lacey acknowledged the role of racism in society.
I'm a Black person. I grew up in this city. And when I look at the number of people who are Black and brown who are in custody, we need to look further back down the road. African Americans have been behind the eight ball in terms of distribution of wealth. But by the time it comes to me, people have made bad decisions.
And Rachel Rossi took issue with that comment.
If you're Black in LA, you are 13 times more likely to be arrested. And I refuse to believe that if you are Black in LA, you are 13 times more likely to make bad decisions.
Here's Rossi continuing.
We need a district attorney who understands that the data shows that long prison terms, long felony sentences do not deter crime. We need a district attorney who will stand up to law enforcement where necessary to say, look at the data. And stop fear-mongering. Look at the data.
Wow, and you can hear there in the background, the crowd was definitely engaged in your conversation with them. Now, another huge law enforcement issue is bail. In fact, voters will be faced with a decision on the ballot this November whether to largely eliminate cash bail in California. What do the candidates have to say about that?
They all agreed with the goal of reducing or eliminating money bail in the process of getting pretrial release. But again, Lacey was more cautious than her two challengers. Here's George Gascon.
I have said it over and over again that cash bail must go. I work towards the reduction of the use of cash bail. And I will continue to work towards the elimination of cash bail and looking for alternatives to cash bail. There is no connection between individual wealth and dangerousness. And this is an office that has lost completely the ability to distinguish between one and the other.
Rachel Rossi, who also wants to abolish cash bail, criticized Gascon for not getting rid of it during his nearly 9 years as San Francisco DA. Lacey initially opposed the bill to eliminate cash bail, but she said she came around to supporting it once changes were made.
What about gang enhancements? That's when prosecutors seek to increase someone's sentence because they're a gang member. That's a major issue the DA's office had to wrestle with here in LA.
Yeah, Gascon charged gang enhancements as San Francisco DA, but he now says he would not use them in L.A. Gascon said data changed his mind about enhancements, and he pointed out the recent L.A. Times story about LAPD officers falsifying reports portraying people as gang members to boost their own stop stats. Lacey said gang enhancements should be used carefully where they have strong evidence something was done to benefit a gang. She argued Gascon is being hypocritical.
He's coming here with a different tune to try to pander to people and get him to vote for him.
Wow, so it does sound like this debate got pretty personal.
Both Jackie Lacey and George Gascon tried to paint each other as incompetent leaders. Lacey criticized Gascon for never trying a case before. He's a former police officer and chief of police who was initially appointed to the DA's office. And Lacey pointed out that property crime was very high in San Francisco under Gascon's tenure. Gascon blamed that on police not arresting suspects in car break-ins. And he said Lacey has been opposing reform at every step during her time as DA. Meanwhile, Rachel Rossi, who's running as the outsider, having spent most of her career as a public defender, said both Lacey and Gascon have had their chances to fix the system and both failed to push reforms while they've been in office.
Now, about the crowd, I know many of the protesters in the audience were trying to hold DA Lacey to account for her record on police shootings. What was that conversation like?
Yeah, many folks in the audience wanted Lacey to answer for her decisions to not file charges in most cases of police use of force. Lacey defended her record, and she did file charges in 2018 against one sheriff's deputy who shot and killed an unarmed driver at a gas station in Norwalk. Gascon also said he's the only DA who supported changing the language of California's law governing use of force from a reasonable to necessary standard. He accused Lacey of being beholden to the union representing LA police officers, which is spending big to defeat him.
You have a district attorney that is comfortable looking the other way.
But Lacey hit right back. She said Gascon faced protests in San Francisco, too, and he didn't charge any cops for shootings while he was the district attorney there.
He didn't file on anybody. He didn't have the courage to. People can talk trash, but what they will do when the pressure is on is different.
All right, a lot to think about in this very important race to see who will be LA County's next district attorney. Libby Denkman, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
You can watch the whole debate on our website, laist.com. That's LAIST.com. All right, there's still a layer of sadness in the air here in L.A. because, think about it, this time last week, the city was still stunned over the death of Kobe Bryant. On Friday, the Lakers got back on the court in Staples Center, and LeBron James gave a heartfelt speech to thousands of NBA fans still in mourning. The WNBA, meanwhile, doesn't start until May, but the league that Kobe was an advocate for is also in pain. We're going to hear from one of their all-time greats when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back for more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Those are the chants of the crowd attending the Lakers game last Friday at Staples Center, the first played since Kobe Bryant's death in a helicopter crash a week ago. Before that night's tip-off, the team paid tribute to Kobe, his 13-year-old daughter Gianna, and the seven others who died in the crash. Here's LeBron James remembering the Lakers legend.
This is a celebration of the 20 years of the blood, the sweat, the tears, the broken down body, the getting up, the sitting down, the everything, the countless hours, the determination to be as great as he could be. Tonight, we celebrate the kid that came here at 18 years of age, retired at 38, and became probably the best dad that we've seen over the last 3 years, man.
And today we want to shed light on that part, the father, the coach of his daughter, a champion of youth and women's sports. Back in 2018, Kobe Bryant opened the Mamba Sports Academy in Newbury Park as a center for young athletes. It's where he was headed Sunday with his basketball-loving daughter and two other teenage players when the crash happened. Joining us now to talk about Kobe Bryant and his impact on youth and women's sports is Cappy Pondexter, retired two-time WNBA champion and Olympic gold medalist. Welcome.
Thank you guys for having me.
You were a guard in the WNBA, and I was looking up some of your highlights and your stats. You were kind of a guard like Kobe was a guard in the NBA. He has a similar style. I mean, it's got to be something that it's got to be really painful for you knowing that you two kind of had the same kind of game.
Yeah, it is painful because I just always imagined that we will always have more time because I always looked at Kobe as being here forever. I just knew that I would hear his Hall of Fame speech, and I just knew that I would be right behind him. And I can remember our last conversation, we talked about retirement, and he's actually the reason why I hung up my sneakers, because he just gave me the confidence to know that everything was going to be okay and that he was having the time of his life.
Yeah, it's a scary thing for a professional athlete to decide when to hang them up. I know you and Kobe participated in an NBA and WNBA initiative called Her Time to Play in March of last year. Can you tell us about the program and its goals?
The program was a partnership between the Mamba Academy and the WNBA to push girls in sports and to give them an opportunity to use sports as a vehicle to, you know, not only bring a culture together, but highlight women's basketball. And, you know, it was a fun day. The girls were so in love with Kobe. They never let a moment go by where they didn't embrace him. And he didn't let a moment go by where he didn't embrace the young ladies. And it's a conversation that I'll never forget. It's a time, a moment that I'll never forget too. And I'm sure the girls that were there will never forget that moment as well.
Yeah, teaching skills. And I want to get to a clip of Kobe Bryant talking with Jimmy Kimmel on his late night show about his daughter, Gigi.
The best thing that happens is when we go out and fans will come up to me and she'll be standing next to me and they'll be like, hey, you got to have a boy. You and V got to have a boy, man. You have somebody carry on the tradition, the legacy. She's like, oi, I got this. You know, boy for that, I got this. Like, that's right. Yes, you do. You got this.
Yeah, Gianna wanted to play for the University of Connecticut. I know you went to Rutgers, Cappy, but arguably UConn is one of the greatest college basketball programs, men or women, of all time. When it came to his relationship with Gianna, what were you able to see firsthand? What kind of things stood out to you?
He was a father first. You could tell because I know Kobe's intensity, even when he was coaching her, you can see that. You know, he did it in a very gentle way. It wasn't the Kobe that we knew on the court. You know, although he practiced and preached the Mamba mentality, he just did it in a more gentle way. And I think it was very loving, you know, because you could see the father and the love that he had for his daughter on the sidelines. Once you become in that leadership role of being coach, that's the first thing that you think about. You think about those younger kids always. You put them before yourself. And it's the whole point of retirement and enjoying the game outside of playing the game. It's the only way that we have to kind of give back. Not having Kobe around and thinking that he'll never be around and help change the women's game. And his daughter, Gigi, who loved the game just as much as Kobe did at the age of 13, you could see the potential. And I just imagine her going to UConn and her playing in the WNBA because it was her goal, and Kobe wanted to make that goal a realization.
Yeah, I remember seeing a picture of him wearing a WNBA sweatshirt. And for, you know, for many people, they're like, well, it's a big deal, it's a sweatshirt. But it's a statement, right? I mean, it's a statement that, hey, there is something, there's another league out there that you need to pay attention to if you don't know about the WNBA and just women in basketball in general.
Kobe gonna make that sweater very famous. We didn't know the impact that Kobe would have. We knew that we were terribly missing, but we just didn't know the impact. And I think that sweater, that statement that he made is gonna change lives forever. A figure such as Kobe, you know, in the sports community and the entire universe is huge, and he was a big advocate of it. He started dedicating his time so much to women's basketball that he could have ran for president if he wanted to and became the president of the WNBA right away. That's how much of an advocate and confidence that we had in Kobe Bryant.
One thing, Cappy, and I know this might be an uncomfortable question, but considering how he supported women the way he did, has that ever led to any conflicted feelings considering his past, his assault allegation in the past?
I don't know Kobe as that. I know Kobe Bryant as being the one with the mama mentality. Kobe is a father. He's a husband. He got married at such a young age, and still to this day, he was able to have his marriage. I mean, that says a lot about him and Vanessa and their commitment to each other. Hell, they had the mama mentality when it came to being together. Kobe is the best basketball player that I've come to see since Michael Jordan, and that memory will last for me forever.
Considering how high profile Kobe was in his support of women and girls in sports, he's gone now, Cappy. How do you think the void will be filled? What's the plan going forward?
Honestly, nobody knows. You know, the only thing that we can do is continue to look at his videos. We can continue to look at his pictures and just see that smile that he carried every single time, no matter who the picture was for, what it was for, his smile remained the same. I think that's just something that we can carry on and remember for the rest of our lives and know that I just always thought in my mind that I'll hear his Hall of Fame speech. And I dedicated every single game I wore his sneakers because I admired him so much.
That's Cappy Pondexter, retired two-time WNBA champion and Olympic gold medalist. Cappy, thank you very much for sharing your memories with us.
Thank you, guys.
If you missed any part of Take Two, just look for us wherever you find your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can also find me there as well at A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.